Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with some of the world's biggest central banks announcing they will take coordinated action to stop the European debt crisis from tanking the global economy. The former chief economist for the US Senate Banking and Budget Committees and now the director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Robert Johnson, joins us. As Europe enters a critical 10-day period ending on December the 10th after the European Union summit, by which time the Italian Prime Minister has warned there will be no more room for error, we will discuss whether Europe can be saved from itself. Then Dan Kennedy, who writes a weekly column for The Guardian, joins us to discuss his latest article, Why Liberals Should Be Rooting for Romney, which argues that while Obama supporters hope for one of the many flawed Republican presidential candidates to get the nomination, they should be careful what they wish for. If the already ailing economy collapses and unemployment soars, then instead of a moderate, pragmatic, and results-oriented Romney, who is everything today's Republican Party is not, as a Gingrich or a Perry could get elected and America would lose. Then finally, George Lakoff joins us. He is the author of The Political Mind, Moral Politics, Don't Think Like an Elephant, and Whose Freedom? He argues that the next step for the Occupy movement is to occupy elections. Just as the Tea Party gained power, he feels the Occupy movement can change the nation by engaging in electoral politics because elections focus attention on public discourse, and so far the 99% versus the 1% has opened a national dialogue that has to be built upon. Joining us now is Robert Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, Robert Johnson was a managing director at Soros Fund Management and was chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And do you think that the world's large central banks that have launched this coordinated action aimed at shoring up the international financial system, that's the U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the central banks of the U.K., Canada, Japan, and Switzerland. Is that a sufficient firewall, do you think?
I think the central banks are actually operating in the midst of dysfunctional governments and dysfunctional financial system. Our financial regulatory system was revealed in 2008 to be a dreadful mess. And it is, at this juncture, so bad and so dysfunctional that something the size of the state of Nevada, which is about what Greece is not able to be, how would I say, restructured or resolved without bringing down the whole world. So the central bankers are responding to the fact that a year and a half ago, at the time of Dodd-Frank and its equivalent around the world, they didn't do the real work. And we're all in danger of suffering as a result.
But could we have, as what a number of economists I've spoken recently with Sheryl Schweniger and Dimitri Papadimitriou and a number of other economists as well, Tom Ferguson, all of whom have said that this so far has been too late, and that there could be another Lehman Brothers event if the Europeans don't get their hands around this.
I think that's right. I think there could be something of the scale of Lehman Brothers. But the interesting question right now is, why are the Germans and the French, 18 months after this started, not doing something to take the pressure off? And it feels to me like what's going on is that there's a very, very substantial elite energy that would like to crush the Spanish, the Italian, the Portuguese, and the Greek states, and what you might call eradicate the structure of social democracy that has existed there throughout the time of the Cold War. And the Germans know what to do. They're just choosing not to do it.
So some people have suggested there's a kind of a racial component to this, the North versus the South, the idea that the Northerners see themselves as thrifty and tax-paying, and they see the Southerners as being profligate and lazy. But my understanding is that all of the bailout money doesn't go to the people in Greece and Italy and Spain and Ireland and Portugal. It goes to the largely German and French banks who made these bad loans.
I think that's right. And I think that I don't want to say that necessarily the officials in finance ministries and central banks are what you might call friends of banking power. I think they're actually terrified of banks because they think they could unleash a Lehman-like episode if they don't pander to them. It's sort of like they're paying ransom on behalf of a hostage situation. And I think there may be, as you say, a racial component to it, but there's also a kind of structural component to it. Before the end of the Cold War, all of these European social democracies paid the equivalent of an insurance premium, meaning good living conditions, good wages, good benefits, problems if you had unemployment, because they didn't want to switch to communism. But they don't pay the insurance premium anymore because they don't fear the accident. Once the Cold War ended, there was no prospect of these people switching to the communist system. And so all the business and everybody else just want to squeeze out all those costs and all those social protections. And some argue that those will ultimately be squeezed out anyway because we're all driving towards Vietnamese, Indonesian, and Chinese labor and social conditions in the globalization arbitrage that's been going on for 20 years.
So then could this be another one of Naomi Klein's crisis capitalism events?
There's a shock doctrine in all of this, which is they use the stress
to break
the democratic process and impose a technocratic top-down solution, which essentially, to use Mansur Olson's old work, Logic of Collective Action, where the concentrated and powerful interests defeat the common interest.
So, in other words, this would be a way to undo the social democracies and the European safety net. And so it's not then, Rob Johnson, the question that Europe has the resources but not the capability. You're suggesting something far more cynical.
I don't know that it's cynical. I think it's self-interest. I think that there are a group of people in Europe who want to keep the pressure on. And they may ultimately blink because of the fears of banking crisis and propagation and disintegration of Europe, but they may blink, what you might call, at the last instant after they've wrung every last drop of water out of the Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, Irish, and even Belgian stones.
So that's what the next 10 days are going to be about then.
Well, I think we're reaching the climax in the sense that the system is either going to blow up or they're going to come up with a mechanism to conserve it, and they don't have a lot of time. I agree with the FT columnist Wolfgang Munchau that it's now a matter of days, not months.
So the notion that some of the other economists I mentioned had said, one suggested that all it would take was for the European Central Bank to buy up all of the European sovereign debt at 5%, and that would stop it in its tracks. Another suggested that made the analogy that in 2008, the Fed put up $29 trillion to stop the collapse from tanking the global economy. And by comparison, up until now, the Europeans have only put up a half a trillion in euros. And now they're talking about trying to shore up their fund only to the extent of about 1 trillion.
That's right. Their economy, the European continental, European Union, is of comparable size to the United States, and the scale and the extent to which Ben Bernanke went to clean up after the excesses of the U.S. financial system is orders of, like you said, 29 times what Europe has done so far. And I'm sad that the American people got put at risk to the extent they did by the Fed spending $29 trillion. How would I say, we're lucky things came back a little bit. If they had fallen off a cliff, that would have been one big bill to pay.
But if the Europeans don't get their act together, and if bold measures are not taken, surely that explains what happened at the White House earlier this week, where President Obama, I'm sure in private, was really butting heads with these European leaders. Because isn't his political fate tied to this? Because if the Eurozone tanks, then that will have terrible effect on follow-on with the global economy, not to mention the U.S. economy, and make 2012 the millstone of the economy around the president's neck even greater.
Well, you've got two dimensions here. Number one, Sarkozy, Merkel, and Obama are all up for re-election next year. And the slowdown of Europe would affect U.S. exports, though they're a relatively small proportion, but it would dampen growth. But more importantly, a freeze-up in the world banking system sends a synchronized credit shock all around the world, which is what we experienced at the time of Lehman Brothers. And all of these finance ministries and central banking officials have spent the last 2 or 3 years talking about the evils of debt and how they all have to consolidate. And, you know, we have super committees and so forth. What saved us from going over the waterfall last time was a fiscal stimulus program that pushed us out of the ditch in a crisis. Are they now willing to completely, what you might call, suspend the ideological mantras of the last 3 years and use fiscal policy around the world in a coordinated fashion, like they did after the London summit in 2008? Or are we just going to sit here and crash against the rocks? I think Obama's in real jeopardy right now if the Europeans don't bring this together. And I expect the Chinese and the Americans, before it's done, are going to blink and actually offer to put some money in alongside the Germans. And some of what happened was the Federal Reserve led the charge today on the dollar funding with the new swap lines, because the Americans are scared of what this game of chicken in Europe could portend for all of us.
And today's actions stem from that meeting. But you think it could get worse, and that the Chinese, who have already lowered restrictions on cash deposits, they're starting to pony up more money than they feel is prudent.
I think that they are seeing the slowdown around the world and the dangers of Europe, and they're actually taking prudent action by releasing some of their credit constrictions, because they fear a slowdown. But I think the emergency action that the major central banks took, led by the Federal Reserve, is testament to how fragile this situation is. I think the funding problems for European banks, particularly their dollar funding, was leading to the kind of rise in all kinds of risk indicators about bank default risk that we haven't seen since that period between Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers.
But Rob Johnson, at the end of the day, we're doing all we can from the outside, but on the inside is where it really counts, isn't it? With the ECB and the extent to which they're going to get real about building a real firewall and stopping the bleeding?
It's absolutely the case that without them in the lead, nothing can happen. The euro could break up, lots of banks could default, and it could propagate around the world. There's no question that risk is right before us now. But at some level, do the Germans want to wreck their own system, their export machine, their technology? You know, they sell luxury consumer durables, capital equipment all over the world. They don't have a stake in a world slump, nor the Scandinavians and other Northern Europeans, who are part of what you might call the core of Europe. So it is a bit surprising not to see more aggressive collective action on their part. But I think that is, as I mentioned earlier in this segment, attributable to these kind of what you might call pernicious or aggressive efforts to eradicate the social welfare state that sprung up during the Cold War years.
But surely the Germans realized that as being at the center of the euro has been extraordinarily beneficial for them in terms of their export economy.
It certainly has. Everybody talks about the profligate, you had mentioned earlier, the kind of racial dimension, the profligate Greeks and the profligate Spaniards and what have you. Well, Germany was selling elevators and equipment and automobiles. German citizens who thought now that all of these Southern European summer homes were part of the euro. You know, in the old days, if you bought a Spanish or Italian home and you were German, you had to take a loss every couple of years because they always depreciated their currencies. Well, now, if they were all in the euro, you could do you create a building boom and a buying boom emanating from Northern Europe, where they buy their summer homes like Americans buy, you know, Florida homes and or California homes. And I think we're in a place where the Germans were the beneficiaries of the boom, and they're like an insurance company. A lot of people in America always they joke that we don't have health insurance. We pay premiums so that if we have an accident, we have the right to sue and see if we're covered. Well, the Germans are like an insurance company that's trying to wiggle off the hook in a health insurance settlement because they signed up for Europe a while ago, and now they're trying to say, oh, no, we're not all guaranteeing each other, every man for himself. That's part of what drove the speculators crazy and why this frenzy is unfolded.
Well, also, isn't it true, Rob Johnson, that, for example, Spain, where, by the way, 45 out of 100 young Spaniards are out of work, they went through this housing bubble. There were more houses built in Spain than there were in France and Germany combined. May have something to do with what you were just telling us.
But French and German and British citizens were buying those homes. Those were not just homes for domestic consumption. They were domestic employment, domestic construction, domestic lending.
Right. And the Germans were keeping the interest rates low, right, which created the bubbles.
Yep.
What's good for Germany?
That's right. They were creating the, what you might call, perception that things weren't risky because everything was guaranteed together.
Right. So fair weather friends then, I take it.
That's what it feels like a little bit. And right. I think the idea that the whole world ought to, like, be put through the ringer now and democracy's destroyed to protect bad loan decisions by German and French banks is an interesting notion. I mean, they talk about this stuff called moral hazard.
Right.
Like, the only people that are imbued with moral hazard are finance ministry officials in Southern Europe that don't tax enough or they spend too much. But when bankers in the north make bad loan decisions, when creditors make mistakes, they put these democracies through the ringer and they destroy these societies rather than restructure the debt. And the combination of austerity and crushing political change is only one alternative that's available logically. Restructuring the debt could have happened preemptively a long time ago in Greece, in Portugal, in Ireland relating to the banking guarantees, and we didn't need to go through this, what you might call, challenge to the structure of civilization.
And just in closing, Rob Johnson, if at the end of the day, if the worst happens, not just here in terms of the follow-on and how it's going to affect our politics, it will lead to the rise of right-wing fascism in Europe, and we've seen that one before.
And because of the cultural differences, you know, people in America are conditioned in many respects to recognize and respect that we're all Americans, but that kind of cohesive fabric psychologically is not present in Europe, and as you say, the nationalistic anxieties and the right-wing polarity can be a very dangerous cocktail for the future of that civilization.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Rob Johnson.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. Previously, Robert Johnson was a Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was the chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether or not the liberals in this country who would like to see one of the flawed candidates on the Republican side get the nomination should be careful of what they wish for.
Nobody knows what to do. we need. Money! Where have you gone to? The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dan Kennedy, who teaches news reporting, media law, and other journalism courses at Northeastern University. He writes a weekly online column for The Guardian and is a regular panelist on Beat the Press. His blog, Media Nation, tracks issues related to journalism, politics, and culture. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is Why Liberals Should Be Rooting for Romney. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Kennedy.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And this is a very kind of quirky, counterintuitive, and provocative argument you're making, suggesting that progressives and supporters of President Obama, who clearly do wish for, and this has been expressed, by the way, by your outgoing congressman there in Massachusetts, Barney Frank, that the crowning jewel of his career is would be Newt Gingrich as a Republican nominee.
Well, I mean, the way I'm looking at it is this. People are assuming that it would be a lot easier for President Obama to beat Newt Gingrich or Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann or Herman Cain than it would to beat Mitt Romney. Romney is clearly the most formidable of this very weak Republican field this year. My fear, and I think it's something that all of us liberals ought to fear, is that if the economy gets bad enough, and it's certainly none too good even now, then conceivably anybody could beat President Obama. And I just don't think that we ought to be taking a chance with one of these more fringy Republicans. You know, we may have our problems with Mitt Romney, but at the end of the day, he's a fairly solid, moderate, pragmatic guy.
Well, you know, that's the argument that you make, is that if our already ailing economy collapses and unemployment soars, and by the way, we're just talking to one of the country's leading economists about how frail the European situation is, and within the next 10 days, we'll know whether the euro is going to tank and drag us down. You know, that instead of the moderate, pragmatic, and results-oriented Romney, who is everything today's Republican Party is not, a Gingrich or a Perry could get elected. And I guess your point is that then America loses, right?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, not that I'm necessarily stay awake at night worrying about the fate of the Republican Party, but I also don't think it's healthy for the country, which we essentially have a two-party system. If one of the two major parties goes completely off the rails, I don't think that's healthy for our democracy either. And I think that ever since President Obama came into office, we have essentially seen the Republican Party go off the rails. And if they were to pick you know, one of these fringe figures as their presidential nominee, I just think it would get that much worse.
So you're arguing, though, also that if a Romney were to become the candidate of the Republicans, that would stop this drift towards right-wing radicalization of the Republican Party, right? It's no longer the party of Lincoln, obviously, but not even the party of Eisenhower or George H.W. Bush.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I mean, if Romney were to become the nominee, I'm not sure that it would stop that drift to the extreme right. Certainly, if Romney were to become the nominee and then lose to President Obama, I suppose that there would be a substantial constituency on the right who will say, well, the reason we lost is we didn't pick somebody conservative enough. And then we go right back to the extreme right-wing philosophy that we've seen the last few years. But at least there's some chance of at least stopping that drift to the right if Romney enjoys some success, because, you know, it's Republican voters who will be deciding who the nominee will be. And maybe if they were to choose Romney, and frankly, right now it's kind of looking like they're very reluctant to do that. But should they choose Romney, I think maybe it sends a message to John Boehner and Eric Cantor and Mitch McConnell and the folks in the Tea Party that even their base constituency has had enough, and they're going to vote for somebody relatively sane like Mitt Romney.
Again, I'm speaking with Dan Kennedy, who teaches news reporting, media law, and other journalism courses at Northeastern University. He writes a weekly online column for The Guardian and has an article at The Huffington Post, Why Liberals Should Be Rooting for Romney. Just back to Barney Frank. He, apart from mentioning that his dream would come true if Gingrich became the nominee for the Republican presidential candidate, would become the Republican presidential nominee, he also said that he's reached a point where you cannot deal with the Republicans in Congress anymore, because he divided them this way. He said that half of them actually believe what Michelle Bachmann believes in. They're totally in sync with her. And the other half are terrified that if they don't go along with the kind of Bachmann Tea Party extremists, they're going to run a Michelle Bachmann against them in the next primary.
Well, you know, I think Barney has a point. That does seem to be the way Congress has gone over the last few years. It's just been total obstruction of anything that President Obama and the Democrats want to do, or frankly, even the moderates in their own party. Certainly we saw just a couple of months ago that it actually looked like John Boehner was ready to sign off on a budget deal that might include some tax increases. And I guess he got the word from the Michelle Bachmann wing of his party that would be unacceptable, because he then pulled the deal off the table at the last minute.
So you're suggesting, Dan Kennedy, in your article, Why Liberals Should Be Rooting for Romney, that he, as I mentioned, you know, that he's moderate and results-oriented and all of that, and that he's a credible candidate compared to the rest of them. I take it that's a lot of that's to do with the time that he was in Massachusetts, because he ran against Teddy Kennedy. He obviously had to tack to the left. But his first campaign commercial that's come out is pretty disgusting, really, for a guy whose main virtue was that he seemed like a reasonably decent and moral guy. It's pretty disgusting what he's pulled off here. So is that a result of a character flaw, or is this a guy, a kind of corporate guy trying to be tough? You know, what's going on there?
I can't read Mitt Romney's mind, and I agree with you that that commercial was absolutely nauseating, the way that it completely lies about what President Obama was saying, or I should say not what he was saying, but who had originally said it.
Right. He was quoting John McCain. That's the point, yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. You know, I mean, Romney has very sharp elbows, and he's certainly, we all know, he's willing to take on almost any persona that he thinks will help him win a few more votes. I'm not suggesting that Romney is some sort of a dream candidate that the country will rally around. I'm just saying that I think he's better than the alternative. If people want to take a chance on an Obama-Gingrich race and then suddenly Newt Gingrich becomes president, well, good luck to them. I don't particularly want to take that chance. But yeah, I mean, as governor, Romney was reasonably moderate. As we all know, he did quite a good job in helping to reform our health care system in Massachusetts. That seems to be one of the principal strikes against him now among members of his own party. You know, he certainly did some things that we weren't too happy about here. When he ran against Ted Kennedy in 1994, he actually said that he would be better for gay rights than Ted Kennedy was. And then when he was governor and getting ready to run for president, he began demagoguing against same-sex marriage. So he certainly does have a well-deserved reputation of taking almost any stand on an issue that he thinks will benefit him at the moment. But I think maybe the reason that liberals ought to be not that worried about Romney may be the same reason that conservatives seem to be so unhappy with Romney. And that is, you know, I think there's a sense that he's not particularly sincere about these ideological concerns. He's really more of a pragmatist. And when he gets into some of these social issues, maybe we shouldn't take him all that seriously.
But again, Dan Kennedy, the point of your piece in the Huffington Post, why liberals should be rooting for Romney, is that Obama could lose no matter who the Republican opponent turns out to be. But to that extent, there's nothing liberals can do anyway, is there? I mean, this is up to the Republicans, right? And the weird thing about the Republican Party is that it's been captured by the religious fundamentalists, who by definition are pretty inflexible. That's the nature of the beast. And this new kind of Tea Party movement, which is, I think, is kind of a repackaging of the far right wing. That seems to be the ascendancy. Where do the traditional Republicans that you mentioned, like the Eisenhower, George Herbert Walker Bush types that used to be, you know, your area of the country used to be solidly Republican, the Northeast.
That's right.
They're an endangered species. Where do you think they have to go? I mean, if one of these more extreme candidates on the Republican side gets the nomination, wouldn't they vote for Obama?
You know,
was there not enough
Michael.
Of them? Sorry.
They very well might vote for Obama, and I think that there's a sense that a lot of them did vote for Obama in 2008. They might vote for Obama this time. They might stay home. I guess John Huntsman is starting to make noises about running as some sort of a centrist independent candidate. Maybe they would vote for him. I don't know.
Do you think he's going to hurt, by the way, do you think he's going to hurt Romney? Because Romney's got essentially all of his eggs in the New Hampshire basket, and he's also obviously hoping for Iowa. He doesn't have a prayer in South Carolina, so it's make or break for him. And apparently Huntsman's strategy is to try and steal his votes in New Hampshire.
Yeah, Huntsman really doesn't seem to like Romney. It's hard to know. Given the state of the Huntsman campaign, it's hard to know why he even stays in it except to do damage to Romney. They must have crossed each other at some point in the past. I don't know. The other thing, of course, that I think that Romney really has to be concerned about, and I'm sure he is, you talk about the evangelicals taking over the Republican Party. A lot of these voters really, really don't like Mormons, and they just would not vote for a Mormon in the primaries under any circumstances. And I think that that may have a lot to do with explaining why, you know, Romney is routinely described as the front runner, and yet he's completely stuck at 25% in the polls. I think a lot of that may very well have to do with religion.
Well, the one guy who for a while was the Tea Party favorite, and I suppose by extension the Christian conservatives were entertaining him as a possibility, Herman Cain, he's probably only going to be around for a day or so more, right? Thou shalt not commit adultery. It's in the Ten Commandments. On the other hand, Newt Gingrich, who expiated to the Christian right on James Dobson's radio show and sought redemption for his adultery, he confessed, he's likely to pick up all of Cain's supporters, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way the polling looks, that Cain support will go right over to Gingrich. It's, I mean, there is something ironic something supremely ironic that Newt Gingrich, of all people, may very well be benefiting from another candidate's marital infidelities. It's the mind kind of reels at that.
As Andy Borowitz, in his satirical column, said that Gingrich has picked up the adulterer votes in this. The adulterous block of voters, you know.
And on a more serious note, it's also more than a little disturbing that Cain seems to have been damaged more by revelations of his marital infidelity than he was by some pretty serious allegations of sexual harassment. Since when did infidelity become more important than sexual harassment? I really don't get that at all.
Well, it's pretty straightforward. It's thou shalt not commit adultery is one of the Ten Commandments, and sexual harassment is a liberal, politically correct invention of the liberal media.
Well, I guess so. I'm just too far inside the conspiracy to see it, I guess.
So, then, just in the last minute, then Dan Kennedy. Just to answer my question, though, which is, you know, I think your point's well taken that liberals and Obama supporters should be careful what they wish for. Is there any way you think to influence the Republicans? Because it seems pretty much ordained that in this primary, it's the right wing and the Christians and the Tea Party that are the activists, and they're the ones that make the decisions, and
you're absolutely right, and I'm really not suggesting that there's anything liberals can do to influence the outcome of the Republican parties, the Republican primaries. I guess I'm just sort of suggesting where people's sporting interest ought to be. Why you should root for the Texas Rangers instead of the St. Louis Cardinals. I mean, there really isn't anything more to it than that, because as far as liberals and Democrats go, this is strictly a spectator sport, and it's going to be up to the Republicans to decide what they're going to do.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Dan Kennedy.
Well, thank you, Ian. I appreciate your having me on.
And I've just been speaking then with Dan Kennedy, who teaches news reporting, media law, and other journalism courses at Northeastern University. He writes a weekly online column for The Guardian and is a regular panelist on Beat the Press. His blog, Media Nation, tracks issues related to journalism, politics, and culture. And his latest article at The Huffington Post is Why Liberals Should Be Rooting for Romney. We're going to take a brief station break, and George Lakoff will join us after the break talking about Occupy elections with a simple message. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. George Lakoff, the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of The Political Mind, Moral Politics, Don't Think Like an Elephant, Whose Freedom, and Thinking Points. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Occupy Elections with a Simple Message. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And you're arguing in your article that the next step for the Occupy movement is to occupy elections. Just as the Tea Party gained power, you feel that the Occupy movement can change the nation by engaging in electoral politics, because elections focus attention on public discourse. And so far, the 99% versus the 1% has opened a national dialogue that should be built upon.
That's right. One of the things that's important about this is that the folks who have actually been in the streets, been in the tents, had the general assemblies and so on, have raised very important issues and inspired a lot of people around the country. Some of those folks don't believe in the political system and mainly want to raise these issues, and they've done so successfully. But there are many others, both those who are in the encampments and those outside supporting them, who would actually function very well in the political system and should be doing so. One of the things that most people don't understand is that there's a general principle behind all of the hundreds of things that the Occupy movement has been both reasonably complaining about and the hundreds of reasonable proposals they put forth. It is not a jumble. It is a structured system, and it's based on a single moral principle. And that is that democracy begins with citizens caring about each other and acting responsibly on that care, both individual and social responsibility, and that the role of government is to empower and protect all citizens equally, and that requires a robust notion of a public, that is, a public that has infrastructure for everybody, education and health available to everyone. That has publicly financed research, that has sewer systems, that has an internet, and all of those things that have been provided by originally by the public, and nothing in the private. Nobody who makes money in this country, no industry that makes money, can make any money at all, can do anything without a robust sense of the public of that sort. Without it, you become, basically like the Congo. I mean, this is a problem. You have to be, you have to have a robust sense of the public for this, and that is a basic message. The idea behind this is government to citizens caring about each other, acting responsibly on that care, and constructing a robust public. That is the simple message that is behind every one of the proposals that the Occupy movement has been putting forth. And all the things that they've been opposing, all of the horrors that they correctly point out, have come from an opposing view of democracy. It's a conservative view of democracy, and it says that democracy gives you the freedom to seek your self-interest without the regard of the interests of anybody else. And that what that does is impose a moral hierarchy. It says the people who succeed deserve to succeed, those who don't deserve it, and therefore the people who succeed are more moral and they should be in charge. And that gives you a moral hierarchy of wealth and power. That is what the Occupy movement is arguing against. The principles in general are simple and straightforward, and all the proposals follow from those principles. They can be taken into the Democratic Party because those same principles are actually, to a large extent, behind what progressives and progressive Democrats are about and have always been about. But they're largely unconscious. They're not stated. They need to be stated and brought out in public. And there's a sort of dirty secret about the Democrats and about Republicans, too, about parties in general. Parties, and especially the Democratic Party, need volunteers. They need people to come in and register voters, knock on doors, distribute pamphlets, get on talk radio, talk in public places, in schools, in business organizations, and so on. You know, they need people to be out there to take people to the polls. They need a tremendous number of people in campaigns. And the people who've been in the Occupy movement have shown that they're competent, that they're able to run these remarkable organizations. You know, an encampment is not simple. An encampment not only requires, you know, setting up a few tents or something, you've got to provide food, you've got to provide safety, you've got to provide sanitation, communication, organization, and that's just what any campaign needs. So what the Occupy movement needs to understand is that if their members just go and join Democratic clubs and only support and insist on supporting only candidates who agree with those general principles about what democracy is, about caring about one another, about being responsible and acting responsibly on that care, about having a robust notion of the public. If those candidates are the ones supported, you can change the country. You know, it is very important to defeat Republican candidates from the Tea Party and other conservative candidates in Congress and to take back Congress. And the Occupy movement has the numbers to do it and has the energy to do it. And I'd like to see it.
But, George Lakoff, I have talked to a number of people involved in organizing Occupy LA, Zuccotti Park in New York, and Occupy Washington, D.C. Some of them, admittedly, are with the Green Party, and they have a kind of reflexive hatred of the Democrats. But, boy, that's a tough sell to say anything about the Democratic Party. And I've actually offered that suggestion on a couple of occasions, making the point that the right-wing Tea Party captured the Republican movement party and moved the national agenda way to the right. Why can't progressives capture the Democratic Party? Because it's a corrupt and hollow shell. And I just draw a blank on that one.
Well, I think what's important here is to understand that there are a lot of different roles to be played in this movement. That's right. There are people who correctly point out that the Democratic Party hasn't done what it needs to have done. That's absolutely right. Their criticisms are very largely, not universally right, but many of them are correct criticisms. And they need to be out there saying them. The folks you have talked to are people who've come out there, who are in the streets, who've set up their tents, who have stayed there, who have hung in there, because they are sick of the way that the Democrats have not been doing their job. And those folks need to keep on saying those things, but they're not the only parts of this movement. The movement is not just the folks who are in the encampments. The movements are all the folks out there who support those in the encampments. And those people have a different role to play. Their role is to be in elections and to change this country.
Well, the universal, I mean, first of all, the framing, if all that the Occupy movement has achieved is framing the debate in terms of the 99% versus the 1%, then they've made an enormous contribution.
Absolutely.
But a part of that is the very clear and present reality that not only have the plutocrats and the oligarchs captured our economy, they own most of our politicians, and that both parties are caught in the trap of these money-driven politics.
But that's where people need to know something that a lot of people don't realize. What money buys a political party is people. It buys them people willing to register voters, to call into talk shows, to get on the internet, to set up a social network, to knock on doors. That's what, you know, to contribute to commercials, etc. That's what money buys. Money buys people willing to work and able to work. And you don't need the money, that money, if you have all the people who are supporting the Occupy movement. That's what the Occupy movement has, people with truth and energy. And, you know, the dirty secret is that that is what the money buys. And we have it, but we're not using it.
And you don't have to be for sale, in other words.
You don't have to be for sale. What's happening, slowly, social movements are taking over our politics. There is, for example, an NGO being set up to raising a small, relatively small amount of money so that anybody who wants to run for office can get a website set up to run for office, but it's a very serious socially networked website with all kinds of interesting bells and whistles. For example, they can the money raised can take videos of campaign debates and then chop them up and put them on these websites showing exactly what, you know, your candidate versus other candidates have to say on each issue. They can do many, many things like that that are cheap, that don't take a lot of money, in many cases are free. It is not the case that money is absolutely necessary for this. It is not the case that, corporations need to be there in order to capture candidates. The Occupy movement, by its energy and numbers, can capture candidates who believe in what they believe in.
Again, I'm speaking with George Lakoff, the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Sciences and Linguistics at the University of California and the author of The Political Mind, Moral Politics, Don't Think Like an Elephant, Whose Freedom, and Thinking Points. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Occupy Elections with a Simple Message. Now, I agree, George Lakoff, that having spoken to a number of people involved in the Occupy movement, including some of the people who began it, it would be such a tragedy if the Bloombergs of this world that closed them down relegated them to their 15 minutes of fame. And there is a tendency on the part of the left and the progressives to be disheartened. And there may be a sense of defeat. This would be the greatest tragedy of all, to cede the field to the Boehners and Gingriches and Cantors of the world, who are so zealously in the pocket of the plutocrats that I think American democracy wouldn't survive another 4 years of Republican rule.
I agree, and we have a grand opportunity. What I see is that the people who are most defeatist are the people who believe least in the country. And by the way, there is some language that really is self-defeating here. There's a language of war that is being used by the more anarchistic parts of the movement. That is war against America. And that doesn't help. That doesn't help change America. You know, there are wonderful things about America, and they need to be made more wonderful. There are wonderful things that have been lost that need to be regained. But, you know, the Occupy movement has a moral message to be delivered. The 99% is where it begins, but that's not where it ends. There's a moral message to be delivered. It's a simple, straightforward message. It governs everything. And there are so many people out there who are encouraged by this movement. It would be devastating if it ends simply by people packing up their tents and going home or being disgusted or whatever, or if the mayors happen to use tactics to get people off the streets. The movement is not what is in the encampments. The encampments just started, this amazing movement, and, you know, the movement is there. It's in the minds of millions of people.
Well, I hope that the movement flourishes, and particularly the anti-corporatist divide, and that the refrain is, and it's not inaccurate at all, that the corporations own both parties. There's obviously a huge battle ahead. But the point in the end of the day is that the battle has to be joined.
it has to be joined, and the Occupy movement has a chance to own a party.
Well,
and what's interesting about the local latest field poll is that 58% of Californians identify with the goals of the Occupy movement, and nearly half of Californians identify with the movement itself. And that is absolutely remarkable.
Well, I thank you for joining us, George Lakoff.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. George Lakoff, the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Sciences and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of The Political Mind, Moral Politics, Don't Think Like an Elephant, Whose Freedom and Thinking Points. He's an article in the Huffington Post, Occupy Elections with a Simple Message. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Rob Johnson, who was the chief economist for the U.S. Senate Banking and Budget Committees. We're talking about the Europeans, who essentially have a critical 10-day period to get their act together, after which the markets will probably crash the euro. And there's some question as to whether the move on the part of the central banks to try and create a firewall against the bleeding of the debt crisis will be insufficient, because the Europeans themselves seem reluctant to act, particularly the Germans. Rob Johnson revealed something that I had not heard before, and actually it's very credible and albeit cynical, and that is that there are parts of the European elite, particularly in Germany, who simply want to crash the economy in order to crash the European social safety net, the social democracies, which, of course, you know, the Europeans are so far ahead of us. They have everything that we take for granted, as we can't even get healthcare. So that was a very interesting revelation, and something that I'd like to follow up on. But on the other hand, he said the self-interest of the catastrophe of a global economic downturn, an event along the lines of a sort of Lehman Brothers crash, may deter the more cynical people behind the scenes, if you will. Then I spoke with the journalism professor Dan Kennedy, who has an article, Why Liberals Should Be Rooting for Romney. And it's sort of an interesting kind of quirky idea, pointing out that if the economy does collapse and unemployment soars, then, you know, one of these crazy Republicans who Obama's supporters desperately want, they'd love him to run against a Bachman or a Gingrich or a Perry, or even a cane, if he lasts any more than a day or so. Dan Kennedy saying, be careful what you wish for, because if one of the more extreme Republicans gets elected, because the economy was so bad, anybody could beat Obama, then America would lose big time. Of course, at the end of the day, that decision is entirely in the hands of the Republican voters. But then the people who vote in the Republican primaries are religious zealots and Tea Party activists. So we may end up with one of these crazies. And then I spoke with George Lakoff finally. He's written some very interesting stuff and done some very original thinking about how the left is poor at framing political ideas and political arguments and agendas. He's arguing that the Tea Party movement's its next step is to occupy elections. And just as the Tea Party gained power, he thinks that the Occupy movement can change the nation by engaging in electoral politics. He suggests that the corrupt and empty shell of the Democratic Party would be the obvious place for them to go. I've pointed out that all the people I've talked to think that they're absolutely a plague on both of their houses. But he nevertheless feels that it would be a tragedy for this powerful discourse, the 99% versus the 1%, not to go forward. And that the real point is that they're not just the people that are occupying. There's a whole bunch of people out there who already share this political idea. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing tomorrow. Bye for now. The man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down.